Veronica Strong-Boag, Interrupted Relations, The Adoption of Children in 20th Century British Columbia, in BC Studies number 144, Winter 2004-2005. Being Young, Journeys to Adulthood. In efforts to match resources with obligations for children, Canadians have regularly employed diverse strategies. In British Columbia, as elsewhere, many biological mothers and fathers have turned to sharing or giving up the care of offspring for intervals from a few days to forever. Parents and children have often attempted to set some of the terms of their separation. The history of adoption in British Columbia supplies one part of this complicated story of interrupted relations. This article takes up the issue of such negotiations in two main parts. In the first, it reviews the efforts of the BC state to determine the adoption of Canadian children over the course of the 20th century. In particular, it outlines critical options and constraints confronting biological kin. The second section considers how birth parents, families, communities, and adoptees themselves have tried to negotiate the terms by which children have been exchanged. Their efforts profoundly influence the experience of adoption. As this account demonstrates, both regulation and resistance have contributed to the diversity that is the hallmark of modern family life in British Columbia. Interrupted Relations is part of a broader study of English Canada's encounter with adoption. Many issues, including international adoption and in vitro fertilization, go unexamined here. Attention to efforts to sever and to affirm the ties that bind is not intended to romanticize or overestimate the claims and agency of kin. Nor does it suggest that regulators and resistors exist in necessarily hostile camps. Alliances of convenience and substance could develop between those who surrendered progeny and social workers, the preeminent agents of the welfare state. The distinctions that follow do, however, reflect influential dynamics in the construction of modern Canadian families. Legislating Adoption, 1920 to 1995. The first modern adoption laws, in 1851 in Massachusetts, USA, followed in Canada by New Brunswick in 1873 and Nova Scotia in 1896, challenged the long-standing common law principle that parents could not divest themselves of legal responsibilities for offspring. They also signaled critical changes in thinking about how to deal with disadvantaged youngsters. First, a mounting sentimentalization of childhood called for girls and boys to be protected and dependent within nuclear families. Second, modern society's growing bureaucratization demanded the formalization of obligations and rights. Third, fear of youngsters unregulated by respectable families increased. A more complete transfer of girls and boys from one set of domestic authorities to another offered one solution to such concerns. By the time it crossed the Canadian Rockies in 1920, legal adoption had become a recognized part of the arsenal of modern child welfare. While policymakers and frontline workers often took considerable liberties in interpreting their mandate, legislation set terms fundamental to the experience of adoption. The British Columbia Adoption Law of 1920 looked simultaneously forward to the adopters and back to the relinquishing kin. As one leading Canadian legal expert, Gilbert Kennedy, professor of law at the University of British Columbia and provincial deputy attorney general, put it, "The 20th century saw a piecemeal transfer of particular rights and obligations from the natural to the adopting family, leaving the common law to fill in the gaps. Adopted children might inherit from both natural relatives and adoptive parents and their legal offspring. Both old and new kin might inherit from adoptees. Secrecy or confidentiality went unmentioned, although the fact of illegitimacy shall in no case be referred to in the order of adoption. Unwed mothers' disadvantages were recognized, at least implicitly, by a 1922 amendment that made their consent unnecessary when their whereabouts were unknown. An amended Adoption Act introduced modern casework principles in 1935. The superintendent of child welfare was charged to report formally on the adopters, the child, and the natural parents. The introduction of a one-year probationary period reassured nervous adopters of time to test the relationship. Much as Ontario had done in 1927, British Columbia sharply limited access to information. Only judicial authorization could permit the searching of legal documents relating to the adoption. For adoptees, the past was a foreign country to which they were given no maps. Birth parents were not, as they might, when placing children in orphanages or reformatories, to retain contact. Increasingly, adopted children were legally reconstituted as full substitutes for natural offspring. Distinctions such as that marked by a 1945 court decision that prevented an adoptee from inheriting as the child of the adopter were targeted as relics of less enlightened times. In 1953, an amended Adoption Act for the first time made adoptees equal in inheritance rights to those born in legal wedlock to the adoptive parents. Reluctance to dissolve earlier property relations survived in the maintenance of the right of inheritance and succession to real and personal property from natural parents or kindred, but mounting determination to rid children of the past soon doomed this provision. Legislative revisions in 1956 and 1957 made a child adopted in British Columbia or elsewhere the same as if he or she had been born to that parent in lawful wedlock. The only remaining connections to the natural kin dealt with prohibitions on incest and marriage. Just as significantly, legislation allowed the exclusion of the public from hearings and further concealment of children's identity. The question of natural parents' consent to adoption and their right to revoke, which drew a mixed response from Canadian courts in these years, also received attention. The prohibition of consent from birth mothers during the first 10 days after delivery and the requirement of affidavits confirming free and voluntary agreement promised more informed surrenders that could not readily be overturned. Other clauses limited occasions for consent. In the event of the failure of adoption, birth parents maintained no rights regarding previously surrendered youngsters, nor did the subsequent marriage of the natural parents to each other give birth fathers any claims. Finally, unless a court decided it was in the best interests of the child, an expression often used to benefit adoptive parents, consent once given was deemed irrevocable. In the 1960s, a series of housekeeping amendments further affirmed the permanency of surrenders. Revisions reemphasized the necessity of informed consent by birth parents, but the relative power of adults in the adoption circle was revealed by the provision that prior adoptions remained valid even if accompanying affidavits failed to state that the person consenting appeared to understand fully what they were signing. In 1964, the reduction of the probationary period to 6 months from 1 year, before which a final adoption order could be applied for, similarly signaled the preference for moving on to new families. In 1968, legislation specified that parental agreement was unnecessary after a child became a permanent ward of the superintendent of child welfare or of a children's aid society. Only that official or agency had to consent to adoption. Still more notable in demarcating past and future was the requirement that adoption petitions refer to the child by the birth registration number only and leave unmentioned the names of the natural parents except where necessary. Legislative enactments from 1920 to the 1960s meant that, as Attorney General Kennedy put it, in a nutshell, adoption is not a separate status with its own rights and responsibilities, but merely a new form or mode of acquiring status as the legitimate child of parents. The shift brought accolades from provincial child welfare workers, whose views were expressed in the annual report of the Social Welfare Branch in 1956. Adopted child is a term heard more and more often with pride and satisfaction in every strata of society. For the child, through the love and understanding of adopting parents and kindred, it holds promise of healthy development, physically, mentally, emotionally, and spiritually. While individual social workers were often committed to sustaining families and placing children with relatives, they appreciated the potential for fresh starts, recognizing the hardships facing single parents and increasingly influenced by psychological rather than moral explanations for illegitimate births. Post-Second World War experts were very tempted to urge the unmarried to move on with new lives and to leave children, the younger the better, behind. Reconstituted families promised a brave new world of tolerance and inclusion. The regional administrator for the Northwest region, which included Terrace, Prince Rupert, and a number of reserves, rightly worried about the very high proportion of foster kids who were Native, some 85% in 1962. But he was greatly relieved to report that it is good to see many of these children being adopted by white foster parents. Similar optimism dominated the first province-wide adoption conference in 1967. Religious authorities, policymakers, social workers, and adopters voiced the prevailing sense of progress in hailing new homes for diverse groups of youngsters. In the same decade, liberal-minded BCers opened branches of the Open Door Society to facilitate interracial adoptions. And in 1968, the Department of Social Welfare won the Silver Anvil Award from the Public Relations Society of America for the outstanding contribution of departmental staff, children's aid societies, community groups, and many volunteers in their imaginative adoption recruitment and interpretation programs. The programs included the first adoption recruitment campaign, the JEF, Joint Effort for Fostering Program, foster parents and youth conferences, the Open Door Society, and the Adoption Conference. A year later, the department cited its own growing awareness of the global needs of people to explain its cooperation with the Adoption Resource Exchange of North America, ARENA. Under its auspices, children unable to find homes in the province were placed in Canada, the U.S., Europe, and South America, and a few from elsewhere found welcome in B.C. The 1960s proved the high point of hopes for assimilation in new households. Increasingly, the cost of new beginnings began to be counted. What enthusiasts had hailed as rebirth and salvation came more frequently to be publicly damned as abduction, even genocide. By the 1970s, provincial ministries grew far more restrained in their hopes for adoption. As provision for Aboriginal children demonstrated, past histories could not be readily discarded. Although provincial child welfare authorities encountered desperate Native families throughout the 20th century, adoption legislation had long made no explicit mention of race. In the 1950s, however, Ottawa began increasingly to rely on provinces to deal with distress on and off reserves. Indian and Métis children made up a growing proportion of those in care. By the 1960s, they were the target of British Columbia's first systematic efforts at transracial placements. However, in 1972, a BC judge's refusal to permit adoption by whites lest the child forfeit Indian status highlighted potential losses. This decision, which prompted an official moratorium on First Nations adoption, went to the BC Court of Appeal, which decreed that status survived adoption and rejected the claim of the would-be adopters that the Indian Act contravened the Canadian Bill of Rights by depriving both adoptive parents and status children of the right given to others to have former ancestry and family ties obliterated. Somewhat contradictorily, but equally revealing of the liberal hopes of the day, the court also argued that the best interests of the child lay in viewing the child as an individual and not as part of a race or culture. A good home environment in which the child could build character takes precedence over a return to Indian culture. The question that remained, could Aboriginal origins, including claims to Indian status, be honored within the context of placements in white households? In 1973, with the advent the previous year of a new Democratic Party, NDP government, led by social worker Dave Barrett, an amended Adoption Act provided that the status, rights, disabilities, and limitations of an adopted Indian person, acquired as an Indian under the Indian Act Canada, or under any other act or law, are not affected. This assertion had profound consequences. As one scholar has noted, the issuance of a status number to an adoptee has the potential to breach the confidentiality of adoption. Continuity with the past was also affirmed in 1975, when the Royal Commission on Family and Children's Laws advocated native homes for native children. However, the NDP defeat in 1975 and the appointment of future social credit premier William van der Zandt as Minister of Human Resources kept further legislative recognition of native concerns waiting another 20 years. Other groups could not be ignored. An outspoken adoption rights movement had been mustering since at least the 1960s, and although resistance was often fierce, it became steadily harder to deny. In 1987, legislation provided for an adoption reunion registry to record details supplied by adoptees and natural parents. The language was replete with conditions. Information was recorded only where the person to whom they relate is an adult, and only at that person's request. Adopters were to remain anonymous. When both the natural parent and child registered, they would be given information. However, if either died, the survivor would only receive notification of death. Amendments only a short time later, in 1987, reinforced provisions for the anonymity of adopters. In the last years of the 20th century, legislators tried to make adoption attractive while simultaneously acknowledging desires to retain a connection with the past. In 1989, they introduced a provision for subsidized adoptions in the hope of enlarging the pool of prospective parents. They also permitted the identities of adopters and a relative, foster parent, or other person with whom there was a relationship that was considered to be important for the child's development to be disclosed to one another. A year later, they permitted adoptions by blood relatives or step-parents without ministry investigation. Only stranger adopters required real scrutiny. Further amendments in 1991 continued in the same vein, with the introduction of an active reunion registry, in addition to its passive predecessor. Unless a contact veto existed, the ministry had to facilitate reunions upon application from an adult adoptee or birth parent. Adult adoptees could request help in locating birth siblings who had been adopted and birth fathers who had acknowledged paternity. Continuing restrictions on the revocation of consent by birth parents and the fact that only a compelling medical need could override contact vetoes also recalled old fears. The NDP administration, led by Michael Harcourt from 1991 to 1996, massively revised legislation. When the 1995 law dispensed with, as if born to, it acknowledged more clearly than ever that adoption created a different kind of kin group. References to birth parents and other guardians, selecting adopters and the latter, receiving the medical and social history of the biological family, and to openness agreements between adopters and natural relations, or adoptive parents of natural siblings, linked new and old. Adopters could now be embedded in pre-existing relations. In much the same vein, the legislation specified that adoption did not necessarily terminate access orders for non-custodial parents. Improved provision for reunion similarly invoked the past. Unless a disclosure veto or no contact order had been filed by birth parents, adoptees 19 years and older could apply for original birth registrations and adoption orders. Birth parents acquired similar rights. All could request assistance in searches. Other provisions requiring youngsters aged 7 to 12 to be consulted, giving birth mothers 30 days to revoke consent, and requiring the Superintendent of Family and Child Services to supply information about adoption alternatives to birth parents or guardians, also enshrined greater sensitivity to the trauma of transfer. but openness as the mention of vetoes and no contact orders suggested had limits, recognizing threats to children's well-being posed by some birth kin. The 1995 legislation made the best interest test the ultimate determinant as to whether unmarried fathers would be notified. When birth and adoptive parents were strangers to one another, the child needed only to be identified by a birth registration number. Courts could also order that the identities of adopters and birth parents not be publicly disclosed. Four groups received special attention in 1995. For the first time since 1973, Aboriginal children were singled out, both by recognition of custom adoption, a reality already acknowledged by the BC Court of Appeal as an Aboriginal right under the 1982 Constitution Act, and by a requirement for reasonable efforts to consult with Native communities. Aboriginal children 12 and older and birth mothers could nevertheless prohibit contact. Equally significant was the provision for applications by two adults jointly. Couples need no longer be husbands and wives or even heterosexual. Provision for a birth father's registry supplied still another telling comment on shifts in adoption politics. The new act also addressed the global traffic in children. In committing itself to the provisions of the Hague Convention on Inter-Country Adoption, British Columbia acknowledged once again that past relations could not always be readily ignored. The evolution of British Columbia's adoption law from 1920 to 1995 directs attention to the struggle to define the best interests of the child. Up to the 1960s, this was increasingly interpreted as requiring a complete break with the past. By the 1970s, new starts were no longer taken for granted. Like other Canadian jurisdictions, British Columbia was forced to find some middle ground between adopters who often wished to be on their own and adoptees and birth kin and communities who refused to sever all ties. The struggle to control the surrender of children. Social workers had long observed that British Columbians regularly tried to retain youngsters and, when this was not possible, to set conditions on their transfer. While many unmarried women, such as Anne Petrie in Vancouver in 1967, surrendered babies in hospitals and maternity homes, the majority did not. As one authority has recognized, adoption has never been the preferred option. Indeed, for many decades, child welfare workers both recognized maternal feeling and hoped to keep the unwed on the straight and narrow by encouraging retention. The heavy infant mortality associated with artificial feeding and institutionalization and the limited demand for babies with any problematic histories also deterred any great enthusiasm for separating birth mothers and offspring. In the 1940s and 1950s, Vancouver's Catholic Children's Aid Society was typical of many agencies in giving special consideration to mothers who wished to keep children but needed temporary financial help. It reported a significant difference in the numbers of unmarried clients and adoption placements. The situation was similar in the public sector. In 1947, British Columbia's Social Welfare Branch calculated that 15 of the 617 illegitimate children known to district offices were in agency care. 105 were placed for adoption, 35 had become state wards, the whereabouts of 230 were unknown, and 232 were with their mothers or relatives. Mothers could draw on traditions of custom adoption that had flourished in pre-industrial societies, including those of the Celtic fringe and North America's indigenous nations. Many non-Aboriginal Canadian families, including my own, have testified to the persistence of individual exchanges. Private plans thrived best in prosperity. The Second World War, for example, increased the number of children born out of wedlock, even as it presented opportunities to keep offspring. As the Superintendent of Neglected Children recognized in 1942, during the past year we have had fewer children to place for adoption, one obvious reason being that when economic conditions are better, unmarried mothers are able themselves to make a satisfactory plan for a child. It is equally clear that women found The help and cooperation of relatives indispensable. Grandparents might be unhappy, but they might well offer support or even accept the child as their own. Maternal aunts, in particular, regularly supply temporary or permanent homes for nephews and nieces. The temper of the times always informed responses. In the 1950s and 1960s, reaffirmation of the heterosexual two-parent household spurred surrenders. Birth mothers were assured that they could leave mistakes behind and ensure better futures for their children. Unlike their supposedly immoral predecessors, they need not be permanently shamed. By the 1970s, as unwed pregnancies grew less stigmatizing and as the women most determined not to give birth had much better access to birth control and abortion, the number of infants available for adoption dropped sharply. Higher rates of retention worried social workers who observed that many women require considerable help. Single-parent workers find that many of the younger mothers who decide to raise their children are girls with a paucity of internal and external resources, and hence require strong and constant support. In 1972, the assistant executive director of Vancouver's Children's Aid Society described clients who visit their children regularly in the foster home. Previously, our foster parents' main focus was to care for the child until the child went for adoption. The focus today is to assist the mother, inexperienced as she might be in some areas, to take her child back. Many foster parents have to almost train the mother in parenthood. Whereas 1950s mothers might have surrendered babies in hospitals, late 20th century successors more frequently waited until lack of resources forced the issue. In the process, children could be hurt, and in any case, older kids attracted fewer adopters. When birth parents could not keep offspring, they sometimes explored other options. Non-standard arrangements contributed to the recurring unreliability of adoption statistics. As the BC government pointed out in 1946, it is difficult to estimate the number of private placements, since many do not come to our attention before legal notification of intention to adopt is submitted, and this may be some time after the child has been placed in the home. Kin adoptions were the most invisible, but other placements were also hard to monitor. The superintendent of neglected children condemned any mother who sought, as he believed, to rid herself of a disagreeable responsibility. She pays no attention to the fact that the home offered may be different in religious faith or whether there is security. Many of these placements are the most difficult we have to deal with, because the mother knows where the child is and is apt to interfere. One case in which we are still trying to find a solution is one where an unstable mother placed her child with the people for whom she worked. Every few weeks, she changes her mind as to whether she wants the child adopted. Even should the adoption be completed legally, the adopting parent's home can never offer the child complete security because the natural mother is just unstable enough to keep upsetting the child's loyalties. In 1950, BC authorities nevertheless had to admit that most of the 219 children placed privately were reasonably safe and secure in their new homes, because it is probably true that the average couple seeking to adopt a child have a genuine warmth and love for children. Despite increased state regulation, private placements remained extremely popular. Between 1971 and 1992, despite a drop in overall numbers, private adoptions outnumbered those arranged by the ministry. Whatever the results, and it should be remembered that tragedies were more likely to be reported than were successes, private arrangements had always, in fact, promised some birth mothers the prospect of more control. For many years, maternity homes had offered space in order to enable women and their families to sidestep public scrutiny. Some, such as Nova Scotia's Ideal Maternity Home, became notorious. In 1939, British Columbia's Superintendent of Neglected Children highlighted recurring dangers. The practice of falsifying the name of the unmarried mother and giving her the name of a would-be adopting mother makes it possible for the latter to register the child as her own. Such a practice was carried out in a maternity home now closed. Children were given to adopting parents either with false birth registrations or with a document purporting to be an adoption certificate. The tracing of the child is extremely difficult. We have reason to believe, therefore, that children may have been missed and it is doubted whether they will ever be identified. Experts regularly traced mistakes to the vulnerability of birth mothers. In 1946, the province's social assistance branch typically condemned the extraction of surrender agreements for mothers too soon after delivery. An admirer of the Children's Aid Society of Vancouver was still more censorious of premature decisions that placed children either in hasty and ill-considered adoptions or in commercial baby homes. In their enthusiasm for profits, baby farms readily lost interest in the personal histories of clients. The result might well be short and long-term devastation for both mothers and infants. Throughout the 20th century, social workers remained suspicious of doctors and lawyers who mediated individual exchanges. Officials of Victoria's Family Welfare and Children's Aid Society summed up common sentiments. Often plans have been suggested by well-meaning friends, relatives, and even some doctors and lawyers, plans which ultimately mean heartache for the girl and frequently complications for adoptive parents. Claims to professional expertise were clearly at stake. In the 1960s, the BC Medical Journal still took for granted an important role for physicians, although it advocated coordination with casework professionals. As late as 1973, the Superintendent of Child Welfare publicly chastised two obstetricians, one of whom talked at a cocktail party of placing a baby with a couple who live only a few blocks from the natural mother and father in a small, closely knit community, and another who removed a 5-day-old infant from his 16-year-old mother, thus jeopardizing the legality of her consent, not to mention causing yet more anguish. Advertising was another resilient private strategy confronted by social workers' determined opposition. As British Columbia's Social Assistance Branch put it after the Second World War, it is through this medium that some of the most unsatisfactory adoption placements are made, and it would seem that British Columbia has long passed the point where we can permit a child to be bartered as a household commodity. Typical of the times, in 1950, provincial authorities censured parents who advertised for children who all needed extensive medical care and treatment. As late as 1980, social workers condemned a Vancouver lawyer's usage of newspapers to troll for newborns for his clients. The continuing demand for babies, especially blue ribbon or white and preferably female, offered some biological parents individual alternatives to legislated pathways. By the end of the 20th century, private placements dominated the adoption of healthy Caucasian infants. In stark contrast, the race or presumed abilities of some youngsters meant fewer takers. Demand for newborns was nevertheless always high, and the shortfall helped unwed mothers place babies considered unadoptable by child welfare experts. As one observer noted, when the loveliest couples wait with mute lips and open arms to take her child, it was easier for a desperate mother to give away her baby. Poverty might well drive such choices, since it was fairly common for the adopting parents to pay the mother's medical bills when she placed her child privately. Nevertheless, as the Legislative Panel on Adoption observed in 1994, many birth parents state that private adoption agencies offer a greater selection of potential adoptive parents. Older children and fathers sometimes surfaced in private transactions. In 1957, the Vancouver province profiled the type of exchange that haunted welfare professionals. Two fathers, one the parent of a murdered daughter, and the other the parent of 5 youngsters he could not support upon the breakup of his marriage, were portrayed as agreeing to let the former take young Christina. Her seemingly irrepressible birth father was also heard to say of a son, "Now I must find a home for 5-year-old David." In October and December 1960, the Vancouver Sun profiled other sad stories. A North Surrey couple facing hard times had, in a written agreement, given their daughter away a year earlier. Although admitting the merits of the new mother and father, they demanded her return. Other natural parents who had surrendered 3-year-old Tammy to a building contractor and his wife proved unable to retrieve her, even when the recipients planned a move to Nova Scotia. a Prince Rupert Hospital orderly offered a happier story. When my wife died, I advertised for someone to look after my 7-year-old daughter. I got replies, but quite a few people were more interested in the money than helping out in a difficult situation. Finally, I found some neighbors who took her right into their own family. She stays with me on the weekend, and I take her out at every opportunity. She has adjusted well to her new life and is having a ball. When my wife died, I had the choice of leaving her with relatives or bringing her up on my own. My family doctor recommended the latter, and I've never regretted it. This father was fortunate in shifting responsibility while maintaining contact. Like others, he assumed the right to make individual arrangements. Parents' determination to retain options was similarly visible in attempts to revoke consent to adoption. Legislative prohibitions sometimes proved imperfect deterrents when Canadian court decisions proved unpredictable. One immigrant unwed mother, who from the perspective of social workers did not appreciate the new world's up-to-date perspective on consent with its irrevocable finality, appealed to the Supreme Court, which returned her son in 1958. She was not unusual. In 1960, biological parents were prominent among those who contested some 25% to 30% of the 1,358 adoptions that proceeded to court in British Columbia. As step-parent adoptions increased, access of the non-custodial parent, commonly the father, complicated the story of efforts to maintain contact. While biological fathers do not generally have a pretty history in regard to out-of-wedlock offspring, some have treasured paternity. Children's mothers have been frequently suspicious, sensing, often quite rightly, harassment. In Canada, all jurisdictions faced challengers to potential severance of access, and in 1985, a leading Canadian legal authority claimed that BC adoption orders neither terminated access orders nor barred applications for access. Provisions for non-custodial parents were part and parcel of renewed deference to blood ties in the last quarter of the 20th century. Continued access was also the logical counterpart of the Supreme Court's decision that Aboriginal status survived adoption. Communities beyond the nuclear family could also be very interested in the fate of girls and boys. Some groups with strong collective identities had long made provision for disadvantaged young in institutions such as Victoria's Protestant Orphans Home, Vancouver's Providence Orphanage, and New Westminster's Loyal Protestant Association Orphanage. The effective control of state institutions by middle-class citizens of European descent meant that they could turn to government agencies to express their preferences both for their own children and for all those designated in need of guardianship by non-kin. Other groups such as the Sons of Freedom, a dissident Dukhobor sect, and the Canadian Jewish Congress continued, however, to assert their own claims. Religion has remained a basis for community solidarity. A June 2004 Vancouver Sun headlined Quadra Islanders' efforts to oppose the adoption of two foster children, both victims of fetal alcohol syndrome, by a couple who were members of Jehovah's Witness, a religious sect frequently regarded suspiciously by other Canadians. Islanders had many counterparts in affirming their own sense of community against the ministry's claim always to do what's best for the child. Aboriginal peoples mounted the most persistent collective resistance to state regulation of adoption. Much as with disadvantaged families of other origins, relatives and neighbors supplied the first line of defense. Custom or traditional adoption was part of the social fabric when Europeans arrived, and such exchanges continued eventually to win legal recognition. Native critics of state child welfare repeatedly insisted that traditionally the care of a child is the overall responsibility of an extended family, with members of that extended family playing various roles. This practice has been in place since time immemorial and allowed our nations to prosper in our lands until the intrusion of European law. Tradition made grandparents appropriate custodians, and it made children deserving of hearings. After 1982, Aboriginal commentators cited customary adoption as an Aboriginal right under the Constitution Act. Youngsters in the care of relatives have often escaped scrutiny in both Native and non-Native communities. The allocation of British Columbia's social allowance in 1966 was nonetheless suggestive. In February, 330, or 3.45%, of reserve recipients were children living with relatives. In March 1966, only 653 youngsters, or 1.01% of all BC recipients, were similarly placed. The comparison was all the more stark since, as a proportion of all those aged 0 to 19 years, the incidence on reserves was 20 times that for the general population. Aboriginal families were clearly generous supporters of the young, and they often got little help. In 1969, Ottawa and Victoria agreed that human resources would provide child protection services and in-care services, but not family support services, daycare services, infant development, or pre-protection services. By 1976-77, Native children were estimated at some 40% of those in care in British Columbia. While they were rarely preferred adoptees, greater racial tolerance gradually opened the homes of whites. Native adopters were unusual. Many possible candidates already helped disadvantaged kids or were intimidated by state authorities. Aboriginal girls and boys were likely to remain in white foster care. As early as 1961, the Vancouver Children's Aid Society reported 160 Indian or part Indian racial origin girls and boys in paid homes. As Table 2 indicates, the majority of children of Aboriginal heritage placed inside and outside British Columbia were the offspring of interracial unions, while it is impossible to know for sure. The fact that children could draw on only one half of their lineage may have undermined traditional support in First Nations communities. On the other hand, partial white or Asian parentage made youngsters more appealing to some would-be mothers and fathers. Growing levels of apprehension provoked widespread alarm among both natives and social workers. Tom Berger's report on Family and Children's Law in 1975 confirmed much disillusionment with old practices. So, too, 2 years later, did the recommendation from the Canadian Psychiatric Association that Native adopters be given preference over non-Native adopters. In 1974, BC child welfare officials signaled their awareness of the need for change by opening on the Hagwilgut Reserve near Hazelton the province's first on-reserve receiving home with Indian foster parents. The Ministry of Human Resources, MHR, placed great hopes on the Royal Commission on Family and Children's Law, admitting the serious suffering that exists among the Indian people of our province and their courageous struggle to reestablish themselves as a noble and independent people. In the meantime, MHR counted on discussions with the Union of British Columbia Indian Chiefs and the British Columbia Association of Non-Status Indians to find and develop homes and capacities whereby the Indian families and communities can more readily maintain and care for their own children. Also notable that year, BC Child Welfare authorities for the first time in an annual report claimed that the wishes of natural parents are not overlooked in choosing a home for their child. Such shifts helped to inspire the appointment of Indian case aides in the Cowichan area, as well as the reconsideration of natives who could not readily match the economic credentials of other prospective adopters. Aboriginal outrage at the loss of youngsters was widespread, and the Spelumcheen Band stood in the forefront of nationwide protest. In the early 1960s, nearly all its children were in the care of human resources and in white homes. By the 1970s, many had returned to the reserve. Some had died and many were in distress. The band, led by Chief Wayne Christian, himself a former foster kid, formulated its own child welfare bylaw and hired a social worker to assist reserve placements. On Thanksgiving Day 1980, the band organized a caravan that occupied the front lawn of the Minister of Human Resources, demanding the children's return. It also persuaded Ottawa to mount a pilot project on reserve-based child welfare resources and services. By 1989, many bands were exploring distinctive and innovative approaches to child welfare. The Legislative Committee, assessing adoption legislation, summed up the prevailing response in 1994. The members of the Aboriginal community who spoke to us were very clear that no more children can be adopted outside of their community. Such protests helped sustain ministry initiatives, such as the appointment of a Native Indian Child Welfare Advisory Committee in Vancouver's downtown east side, and plans for a crisis nursery run by Indian parents. Later in the 1980s, the Nechanoth Tribal Council and the Carrier Sakani Tribal Council signed child welfare agreements with Victoria, which also agreed to consult the province's other bands. In addition, the ministry committed itself to requiring non-native homes to keep adoptees in touch with their heritage. In 1988-89, the Superintendent of Family and Child Services for the first time delegated full authority to social workers in an Indian Child and Family Service program, the Nechanoth Tribal Council. The return of the NDP to power in 1991 soon restored the moratorium on adoptions of Native youngsters by non-Natives. Adoption was, however, only one expression of deeply entrenched inequalities. Although the great majority lived with birth parents, Native children continued to be disproportionately apprehended. Aboriginal peoples did not always agree with regard to solutions. Some urban Native birth mothers had few positive connections to reserves and rejected band involvement. Their resistance caused the Royal Commission on Family and Children's Law to conclude that we must support the mother's right of self-determination. Tom Berger also discovered adoptees who reported a positive adoption by non-Aboriginal families, and he recommended that bands acknowledge such feelings. At the same time, he agreed that adoption, like Indian residential schools, undermined Aboriginal communities. Like the First Nations of the province, Berger understood that the fate of children determined survival. But he, too, had no easy answer to the complex history of misunderstanding and abuse. Native assertion of the significance of origins has been highly visible, but British Columbia has also housed an active adoption rights movement. In theory, inclusive of both Aboriginal and non-Aboriginal members of the adoption circle, the searching community of parent finders and other such groups has been predominantly white. Fairy tales of the chosen, with their stress on the agency of adopters and the good fortune of the rescued, were publicly questioned in the 1950s and 1960s. Time and distance did not necessarily prevent the efforts of blood kin to reunite. After the Second World War, Vancouver Island's Fairbridge Farm School supplied typical examples. One boy returned to Britain for his family, while the mother of another realized a dream of many years when she came out to Canada and established a home for her son. Modern searchers have condemned adoption laws that infantilize them. Unlike other adults, they have been barred from critical histories. According to them, amnesia is what it feels like being adopted and knowing nothing about your biological background. However unhappy old allegiances, and however rewarding the new, searchers demanded access to original records as they drew on the lessons of post-Second World War liberation movements. In 1974, Joan Vanstone, a searcher, initiated parent finders after a meeting for adult adoptees sponsored by Vancouver social worker Honor Mowinkel. Vanstone was also inspired by Jean Peyton, the influential member of the searching group orphan voyage in the United States. Another BC pioneer was Claire Marcus, the author of Adopted, A Canadian Guide for Adopted Adults in Search of Their Origins, 1979, and Who Is My Mother, 1981. Born in Winnipeg in 1924 to an unwed mother and adopted from a maternity hospital, she worked as a journalist for the Winnipeg Free Press and the Star Weekly. She also sought her birth parents, eventually moving to Vancouver in the 1960s, where, enraged by a system that denies basic human rights, she became a full-time searcher and parent finder. Vanstone and Marcus had much company. Child welfare authorities always had to deal with individual searchers. In 1970, the Vancouver Children's Aid Society, VCAS, described a 51-year-old man from Fort St. John who sought his original birth certificate and help in locating natural kin. He wrote that the VCAS had placed him as a baby with wonderful parents who would not reveal his background. At their death, he was alone. The VCAS sought his records, which, like many others, were incomplete. Fortunately, on the back of the file cover in faint pencil was a name that could be cross-referenced. He responded jubilantly, thanking the wonderful cooperation from all the agencies I contacted and supplying a story of reunion with his siblings and plans for meeting his mother. He concluded, "Thanks to your kind letter and its contents, even after 51 years, I now have a family of my own. Many thanks." He would not have been so lucky if he had contacted the provincial ministry. Victoria officials nonetheless acknowledged that adoptees searching for health and social information consumed increasing resources. In 1971, for the first time, the MHR annual report admitted the natural desire for reunion and mentioned a registry. The appointment of the Family and Children's Law Commission spurred further requests for reunions and a provincial registry. In 1975, Justice Berger, sympathetic to the argument that adoptees suffered what the academic literature termed genealogical bewilderment, recommended providing non-identifying information. Just as revealing of the politics of the day, he deferred to many adopters' rejection of an adoption reunion registry. Private initiatives struggled to fill the gap as BC parent finders created the first national voluntary registry. Later on, Family Services of Greater Vancouver set up a busy adoption reunion registry. By 1981, requests to the government for information had jumped from approximately 6 per year in the 1960s to 30 per month in the mid-1970s. Ministry officials tried to hold the line, but May 1980 brought the first BC application to the Supreme Court for access to records. The judge ruled that good cause was not demonstrated. As tables 3 and 4 illustrate, this rejection proved little deterrent. Steady pressure led to the creation of both passive and active adoption registries. By 1994, the Provincial Panel to Review Adoption Legislation concluded that open records were consistent with the values upheld by the Aboriginal peoples of British Columbia and with many other cultures. Even the concerns expressed by the Lower Mainland Fetal Alcohol Syndrome Effect Support Group met with the response that specific groups of children should not be summarily denied the right to have ties with their birth families. The adoption rights movement had come a long way. More difficult to challenge were the original failure by governments and agencies to keep detailed records and the limited ability of cash-strapped departments to track kin. Conclusion. The history of adoption in British Columbia demonstrates how child welfare authorities tried to work out relationships between adopted children and their past. early legislation recognized ties to two families, albeit often because suspicions about the heredity of adoptees impeded their full integration into the adopting family. From the 1930s to the 1960s, adoption laws, inspired by an increased confidence in environments, attempted to integrate newcomers seamlessly into adopting households. In the last decades of the 20th century, strengthened efforts to assert control by birth parents, native peoples, and searchers changed the face of adoption once again. Surrendering families were increasingly likely to retain knowledge and even contact with youngsters, just as they might in custom adoption. Even tragic relations had not stopped daughters and sons, mothers and fathers, and still more remote members of kin and cultural communities from valuing connection with one another. While adoption has profoundly improved many individual prospects and rescued numerous children from tragedy and abuse, it has also sometimes left injustice and despair in its wake. While far from the entire story, interrupted relations too often obscure an ugly reality that many have an interest in forgetting. Reconnecting with the past makes it more difficult to ignore ongoing relations of disadvantage and advantage that underpin so many exchanges of children in British Columbia and elsewhere.